The Tom Woods Show, episode 2223.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Come on now, folks. If you ain't going to start that side hustle now, then when? Check out my free ebook, Five Paths to an Online Income, where I take you step by step through five things that I do that keep food on the Woods household table and how you can do them too. Check it out at pathstoincome.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. Our old friend Ryan McMakin is back on the show with us. He is senior editor of Mises.org. You should check out Mises.org if you never have, Mises.org. But I should warn you, if you check it out, you'll be sucked into it for weeks at a time. Your friends and family are going to kick down your door to make sure you're all right. So check that out at your peril. There's so many great resources there. Ryan is the author of the book we're going to be talking about today, which is Breaking Away, The Case for Secession, Radical Decentralization, and Smaller Polities. Welcome back, Ryan.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be with you.
You know, I saw you, of course, in Phoenix a couple of weeks ago for the Mises Institute conference, and you used a phrase that I like very much, which is status quo bias in your remarks. And just the other day, I had on my show somebody from the Greater Idaho Movement. And I titled that episode in a way that didn't make immediately obvious that the episode was about the border between Oregon and Idaho, because I had this funny feeling nobody would care about that. And yet, in a way, they should, because if we manage to have some success on small matters like that, like the border between Oregon and Idaho, not the creation of a new state or the secession of an existing state, but just a small change like that, then it opens their minds to other possibilities, because suddenly the lines drawn within the United States are no longer sacred and dictated by heaven and unthinkable to change and so on and on. But in particular, that phrase status quo bias kept coming through, because this is an arrangement, or this is a plan for Greater Idaho that would have a chunk of the rural portion of Oregon go over to Idaho that basically would benefit everybody. That everybody, I mean, not literally everybody, but far more people would get what they want than are getting it today. So it seems to me the only thing stopping them from just doing this instantly is just a status quo bias. And it's so interesting. It's like American exceptionalism rears its ugly head again, whereby every other country can split up or change its internal boundaries or whatever, because they're just dumb loser countries. But the United States of America, well, we just absolutely can't do that. They don't object at all to any of the expansion of the U.S. in the 19th century or the addition of Alaska and Hawaii. None of, absolutely not one of these people object to that. It's fine. It can expand all at once. It just can't ever change anything, you know, in terms of its internal borders, or ever go backward and have a separation. I think that's our major obstacle.
It really is. And I think you're right. I think if people just start to come to terms with the idea that borders can and do change a lot, that they'll stop freaking out quite as much over this idea of something so minor as changing the border between Oregon and Idaho. I mean, we had something similar to in northern Colorado, where northeastern Colorado, which is mostly rural, they did have one metropolitan area up there, Greeley. And there was just discussion of more of breaking off from the state or merging with Wyoming or something like that. And people acted like this was just crazy. They weren't going to leave the country or anything. It was just changing, being ruled from Cheyenne instead of Denver was going to be the only change, right? And this was just, oh man, you can't do that. You would have to have elections and then Congress would have to approve it. As if, I mean, what would there be even to debate in Congress? A bunch of people have never even set foot in northern Colorado or Wyoming. We're going to debate whether it was wise to allow that part to join another part. But the level that people freak out over this is quite astounding.
The fact that people are willing, you know, just on a dime to accept, let's say, as I put it, at the very least, highly controversial gender theories. At the drop of a hat, that's what you want me to do? I'll do it. At the drop of a hat, they'll go from, I don't even know who Saddam Hussein is, to he is my mortal enemy. At the drop of a hat. But the boundary between where you live and this other place, we might want to move that over a few miles. Now, that's unthinkable. I mean, I'll slaughter a million people in the Middle East if you ask me to. But this border being changed, now, that is just a bit too far. Again, I don't know. It's unbelievable. The conditioning that people apparently undergo in the U.S., whereby some things are easily accommodated and others are unthinkable. That doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to it. So that's why we want to do this episode, because at the end of this episode of the Tom Woods Show, the entire United States will be ready for the next step in American history, which is radical decentralization. Now, when you talk about decentralization, people will come up with all the objections in the world. And some of them are not stupid. You know, they're not all ridiculous or just showing a lack of imagination. I can at least understand where some people are coming from. And so, for instance, even in this Greater Idaho movement, there were some of the same kinds of objections raised. For instance, I know there are people who would say, and by the way, I know your book is not entirely about the United States, but let's take the United States. There are some people who would say, why should we break apart when we should instead fight on and try to have political victories all around the country? We're giving up if we withdraw. Well, likewise, that's what they say here, that we shouldn't break off from Oregon. We should just keep on fighting. Why don't we keep on fighting? Or secondly, why don't you just move to Idaho? If you think Idaho is better, why don't you just move to Idaho? Well, of course, I don't want to move to Idaho. Why should I be the one who has to move? They're the ones who are oppressing me. They should move. Anybody should move. I don't want to have to move. But this argument that you're kind of giving up on getting the whole bowl of fruit by seceding, how do you answer that?
Well, there's two things you could do. I mean, first of all, seceding and redrawing lines doesn't mean you've just given up the argument, right? You can continue to try and convince people in those places you've left behind that they should be more like you, that their ideas are bad. But in the meantime, you've got this short-term, this immediate solution, really, where, okay, I've managed to just separate myself a little bit from these people who have terrible ideas, but then we can continue to engage them. And of course, when we're talking about state lines in the U.S., right, you still got free trade between them, free movement, all of that. It's just not even that big a deal. But I do reject this idea that everyone's ideas are static forever. And so if we redraw a boundary, then all of those people on one side of the border just can become even more horrible, even more communist forever. And people on my side of the border will be protected forever. I mean, obviously, that's not the reality. People move around, ideas change, historical events change. And so this isn't even like, hey, I want to break off and not talk to those people. This is, all right, take some action that helps protect some of your rights from some of the more terrible abuses. But of course, you're still going to probably have relatives on that other side. You should probably still take action to try and convince these people to do the right thing on the other side of the border. So it's not this sort of disengagement idea that many people imagine it to be. It's just simply what local governments have done a lot of the time, which is that, hey, look, my interests in this city don't really coincide anymore with the urban government, so we're going to break off and form a different city. Lots of people accept that happens. Now, certainly people oppose that often on a local basis, but it also does happen a lot. And that's just the reality. Interests don't always just coincide with some larger entity. The other second part of it is that, okay, if you've decided that some people in the new seceding territory don't agree then with the secession, well, the solution there is just to have more secession, to have smaller pieces. Maybe this giant chunk you want to break up isn't the appropriate size. All of these things are negotiable all of the time. And so people throw out one idea and, well, this whole huge chunk has to secede, or also everyone now within this new territory is going to have to behave a certain way or subscribe to certain ideas. It's just not that inflexible as people seem to believe. And that's part of the stuff I discuss in the book, is that there's actually a lot of in-between here. There's evidence that smaller countries, countries that are broken off from other countries, they continue to engage. They continue to pursue openness and free trade with the places they've broken off from. A lot of what is thrown out there in terms of, well, this country wants to break away, so therefore we shall all fire up the ammunition and just start killing each other, that's not actually the experience in a lot of cases. So it's just not even as radical as many people suppose.
Before we get into more devil's advocate, I should give you an opportunity to make the case for smaller political entities before I say, but what about this? What about that? So maybe if you could do it in an elevator pitch style, 2 to 3 minutes, what are the major benefits that people might experience if the world had more and smaller states in it?
Well, a big reason is that what you have when you have a large state is you have a lot of diversity, and not necessarily racial diversity, right? Economic diversity, diversity of interests, maybe language diversity. And those are all very real things that separate people from each other. It doesn't mean they can't get along under any circumstances, but it does mean that if you're going to have a government, it should really reflect more the local population that's being taxed to support that government, that's subject to the rules of that government. And what you have when you have a large, expansive state with a lot of diversity in it is that you end up with one oligarchy, one group, one coalition that tends to then serve overwhelmingly its own interests. And then people who are maybe in a distant location or people who are in a minority group, they tend to get the shaft on that. And when you have, especially just a straight up democratic system without a bunch of, say, methods for veto, minority veto, then those people really have no way of exercising their preferences and their values. And so the answer to that is then to break things up into smaller pieces. And classical liberalism has always embraced this idea. Of course, the Americans, right? They wanted to break off so that they could tend to their own interests without having to send everything through the imperial government back in London. And we've also seen it, of course, I mean, when the Irish seceded from England, that was based on similar liberal ideas, was what they embraced. And generally, there's this idea that people have a right to govern themselves and to have what Mises uses as the phrase of self-determination. And Mises, of course, supported secession. So did a lot of the French radicals. Charles Dunoyer, who I recently ran an article on, said he wanted to municipalize the world. That is, he didn't think government should be any larger than a metropolitan area. The reason for this is that self-determination really doesn't scale up. It's something that has to be really more localized to a more homogeneous group. Americans, however, have been kind of hoodwinked by this Madisonian idea that what we need is a big, giant republic where everybody's different and all of their interests cancel each other out perfectly, and that will prevent the government from doing any abusive things. Well, that didn't work out. And you know we didn't work out because less than 90 years after Madison was saying all that stuff, the United States had a horrible, bloody civil war, and they had to completely pitch his old ideas and resurrect a far more unified and centralized government in order to hold the country together by force. So that failed. The other liberals were better on that, that you need to have the balance of government power far more localized. Now, that doesn't mean that something like the U.S. couldn't work, but it would have to mean that power is far more decentralized, that this idea of determining everything from banking policy to school funding and all of that stuff from Washington, D.C., including the welfare state. That's one of the worst things, that it's a centrally controlled and directed welfare state. Big, big problems. And so the way to solve that is through much more decentralization in a confederation like the U.S. But we're moving in the opposite direction for the most part.
When I hear objections to the sorts of things you're saying, I mean, maybe they'll concede your points, but they'll say, as a matter of fact, you address this in the book, if, let's say, somehow all the sane people seceded from California and created a new state, even just that, not even seceded from the U.S., but just seceded from California, then that makes the remainder of California that does not secede even more blue, and you're abandoning all those poor people, you know, who can't move to whatever portion of California seceded, and so they're going to be worse off. And that could possibly be, although I do want to talk about your thoughts on that. But you notice how the comparison is always between our proposal and perfection. And our proposal falls short of perfection because there are still problems. But they never look at the existing status quo and bother to acknowledge the enormous problems with that. Yeah, okay, that's true. My solution doesn't solve everything, but the current system solves nothing at all. Absolutely nothing. But what do you say about the poor souls left behind in California?
Well, and of course, we heard the exact same argument with Spain when Catalonia wanted to break off. It's like, oh, those people are far more to the left, so we can't ever let them leave because then they would embrace farther left political system. So therefore, we must force them to be ruled by Madrid forever. And so, yeah, so you don't just get it in the US, it's something that self-identified libertarians have claimed forever, that people might do something differently somewhere else. So therefore, we have to make government more centralized, larger, and more centrally directed, because you know how successful libertarians are taking control of large central governments. So, well, we'll do that. That'll be the plan. What I note in the book is, if the problem with California is that they break off and you got a bunch of leftists in charge, the answer there is to break up California still further, right? It's not like California is a unified place in terms of its ideology. In fact, you don't have to go back all that far. Just about 15 years ago, when California voted, for example, on the gay marriage thing, the support for that overwhelmingly was in the Bay Area. You had even LA County voted against the whole new provision ensuring that gay marriage was a thing and all of that. And San Diego, of course, is quite different from Northern California. And then that's not even to mention all of the more rural areas inland. So this idea then that, yep, California pulled off, so now they're all going to agree on everything and Gavin Newsom will now become governor for life and democracy will go out the window, become basically a Soviet state. Well, first of all, that assumes a whole lot. It assumes, A, that an independent California would be able to function more or less in the same way it does now, whereas California can support on a lot of support, a lot of welfare support from Washington, D.C. It, of course, doesn't have to worry about foreign policy or any sort of diplomacy, and that just in general, that it would continue in exactly the same way as an independent state than is in part of the U.S., and that it could just simply continue ignoring people outside the major metropolitan centers. But who knows that that would necessarily be the case, especially once it becomes accepted that secession is an acceptable political strategy. So if California comes out and says, yep, well, we get to secede because people get to break off and do their own thing. Well, then what do they say in retort when the San Joaquin Valley says, hey, you know, you got to secede, so now we want to secede and do our own thing and join Nevada or whatever, right? Now, Mises, of course, would say, of course, they should be allowed to join. People should be allowed to break off whatever pieces and join whatever other pieces they want. That's the way you avoid civil war. That's the way you avoid revolution. So the answer to some secession is more secession and let people join other states if they want, other groups form their own coalitions. And so the idea that then California seceding would then be the end of the line and that California would continue to function more or less in the same way it does now as a member of the United States. Well, there's a whole lot of assumptions there. And you're undermining then your case for unity by seceding yourself. That's why one of the greatest things about America and American history is that they can never take away from us the fact that the United States is built on the idea that it is morally acceptable to pick up a gun and shoot soldiers sent from the government to stop you from doing things. And so as much as we're told that that's terrible, the fact of the matter is that's what America is founded on. So that's going to be difficult to overcome ultimately.
Yeah, but you know, honestly, I am shocked at how few people understand what a quote America was founded on. When I read Brian Kaplan's book, The Case Against Education, which some people lectured him on that title, you should have titled it. No, he shouldn't have. That's a really provocative title. That's what makes it good. But anyway, he had statistics in there and data from surveys given to educated adults, educated college-educated adults, high school-educated adults, and just asking them to place, you know, in which century, which decade, or at least in order, the American Revolution and the Civil War and a few other things. There are some people who think the Civil War came before the American Revolution, and not an insignificant number. When you look at how little people know, I cannot imagine how anyone can still defend the current school system. I mean, if this current school system were run in the private sector and it generated results like people barely can tell you anything about the Bill of Rights at all, it would be a national scandal, you know? But whereas today, because again, status quo bias, it's unthinkable. The greatest institution we have are these terrible schools that teach them nothing. What about, though, a super practical concern? And again, I realize this is a very America-focused question, but I have a mostly American audience. What about some of these welfare state programs that people have come to rely on? I mean, is there a practical way? And I don't mean to sound like I'm in love with these programs, but this is going to be a big obstacle if you're going to try to promote this idea to deal with the issue of Social Security that I, quote, paid into my whole life and then Colorado secedes from the U.S., and then they stop paying it.
Yeah. Well, and of course, Scotland encountered the exact same problem, right? When they were talking about seceding was, hey, if you break off, you won't get all these checks from London, your pension checks. So think long and hard, old folks, about whether you want yep. an independent Scotland. Now, of course, they almost got it. I mean, the pretty big number of them voted for it. And so it wasn't just some negligible amount. So apparently some people were willing to just deal with that reality. So in the end, economics tends to take a back seat to just people feverishly coming to a cultural conclusion that I don't want to be in the same country with those people anymore. And I'm just going to deal with whatever economic blowback comes with that. And there's a good article on the economics of secession that I discussed recently with Jeff Deist, where, yeah, that's the reality is actually, if you look at the way that secession plays out in many cases, these concerns are always concerns early in the debate when they're talking about, hey, how's the welfare state going to be divvied up and stuff? But once the secession talk gets going, people become more and more committed to just their tribe and their idea of separation. And then they're like, screw it. I don't know if I'll continue this check, but I can't stand the thought of being in the same country as these horrible people. So those issues, kind of the cultural side, overwhelms even the checkbook considerations, because they know that, right, they'll just get a new state and that state will start taxing and doing a welfare state, which is pretty much what always happens. So I would not expect, if the United States were to break up in smaller pieces, that there would be this totally laissez-faire, no welfare state faction of that. I just don't think that's going to happen. But it is extremely important to start moving toward breaking up the welfare state. And even outside the book, there's an article I wrote years ago called Decentralize the Welfare State. Because as you note, that is a big obstacle here. Because not only do people rely on those checks, they've planned for that, right? They've planned their retirement around it a lot of time. They like getting those checks. But they've even been convinced falsely that that's their money that they paid in. They don't realize that they just paid into the federal government. The federal government doled out that money to right. retirees.
They need
right?
to understand that it is a pay-as-you-go system. There's no yeah. fund that they paid into. So that's what I think they think the obstacle is. Well, we couldn't have another program like this in our new state because we haven't been paying into it for 30 years. Well, you may have been paying into it for 30 years in the U.S., but they haven't been saving it for you. They already blew all that. So if you leave and create your own state, your own country, you're in exactly the same situation in that country the U.S. is in, which is you take the money from taxes and you pay it to retirees.
That's exactly right, right? They're just going to create a new welfare state. You can see that with the breakup of Czechoslovakia, right? Even the Czech Republic and Slovakia, they had a welfare state. They had all sorts of government-owned, government-funded programs. They split it. They split their national debt also. And then they just started up new welfare states. I mean, that's exactly the same thing that would happen here. And in that article on decentralizing the welfare state, I noted that most of these U.S. states, they're bigger than these smaller European states that have their own welfare states. So look at even the poorest state. Let's look at poor state like Mississippi. Well, their GDP per capita is at least as good as Portugal. Portugal has its own socialized medicine, its own welfare state, its own pension system, all of that stuff. So this idea that, well, if you broke up the United States, there wouldn't be enough state capacity to offer a welfare state and all this, completely false. You could take the poorest state and they still would have the sorts of resources available to them as a small European state, not to mention some of these medium-sized or big states, right? State of Texas, 25 million people, GDP per capita about equal to that of Australia. Australia has its own welfare state and they have the same number of people and resources as Texas. But even take something in the middle, like, oh, one of these states that has like 12 million people, like Illinois or something, or Florida with, I think, about 20 million people. That's like a little bit smaller than the Netherlands. And we all certainly know how generous, allegedly, their welfare state is. So, yeah, the idea here that, oh, a broken up state would never be able to afford the welfare state, there's no evidence of that at all. There's lots of small and medium-sized states that have their own welfare states. And yeah, and as you know, it's not different from Social Security in terms of it's just a pay-as-you-go. But that is one of the worst things that ever happened to the U.S. And if you like decentralization, if you like local self-determination, it was the fact that the United States embraced a national welfare state. That's what, in many ways, the EU is better on that because the EU their welfare state is still heavily decentralized, right? The National Health Service is a British thing. And so leaving or joining the EU didn't really affect that. You can imagine, would the EU or would the UK ever have left the EU if their socialized medicine was dependent on Brussels, that they were getting those checks from Brussels? That would have been much, much harder to do Brexit in that case. But fortunately, in Europe, these welfare states are all localized to the individual member states. And the US needs to embrace that idea if it's ever going to be able to really start to break up the US, or at least embrace radical decentralization in any sort of orderly fashion. But there's always the chance and the reality of disorderly breakup as well, which is what happens a lot of the time.
Hey folks, it's time to take just a minute for Woods to improve your life yet again. Have you lost count by now? For 3 years, I have been a happy customer of Happily Date Boxes. Every month, you get a box in the mail with a different theme for a date that you can enjoy in the comfort of your own home. And it gives you an opportunity to spend quality time with your significant other, even with your busy schedule. Just within the past week, my wife and I enjoyed the most recent of these. And this one had a morning theme, so it came with coffee. It came with the ingredients to make crepes, which we did together. As always, it comes with a curated custom date playlist, which we use on Spotify, a series of conversation starters, which we always enjoy. And then it included this time a game we played where we had to write down our answers to different questions about ourselves and then try to anticipate what the other person's answers were, which is hilarious, by the way. And then there was a bunch of other fun stuff, trivia, crossword puzzle, Mad Libs, other boxes. We've done crafts. We've done an exercise where they say you're on a desert island and here are 10 possible things that you might have in your possession. Rank them in order of how useful they would actually be to you. Very interesting and fun stuff. And if you are the one who comes up with the idea, your significant other is going to think you are absolutely amazing. And you do not have to say, Woods told me to do this. You just say, I just happen to be a really, really thoughtful person. Well, take 50% off your first date at tomwoods.com/date. That's 50% off your first date at tomwoods.com/date. Can we finally say something? And this is going to seem so simple to you and me, but to people who don't think about this all the time, it is an issue. People in the U.S., because of the peculiarities of American history, think of secession as necessarily being accompanied by violence. I see this when I bring it up. People think that naturally there will be violence. Is that the norm when we look at the secessions that have occurred elsewhere in the world?
Well, part of the book is, of course, to bring up a bunch of these examples, right? Most people don't even know about cases of secession that have existed, right? How many people even know that Norway seceded from Sweden about 110 years ago and that there wasn't a war over it? This was just accepted. They took a vote on it. There was a plebiscite. It happened. Iceland did the same. They initially, in I think 1917, 1919, established themselves as an independent entity from Denmark. And then in 1944, embraced full-on republican self-rule. So they weren't even in a personal union anymore under the crown of Denmark. No war there. Then let's look at what happened after the Soviet Union broke up, right? The Baltics broke up. Well, Moscow didn't invade. So there was a peaceful secession right there. And at the time, Ukraine broke off and they had a big referendum and they voted for independence and the Soviet government did nothing, even though the New York Times and the Bush administration were appalled that people would break up the Soviet Union, which they thought could be converted into this wonderful democratic state. So you can look at, what, I think, 14 or 15 cases of secession right there where there was no widespread violence at all. How about Slovenia when it broke off from Yugoslavia? They had a 10-day war with a few hundred dead. I mean, with keeping Slovenia by force inside Yugoslavia forever have been the better solution. And then, of course, that doesn't even mention all of the post-colonial secessions that occurred after World War II. And their problems then were civil wars, right? They were all able to peacefully secede and break off from their imperial masters, whether they be in France or Britain. All of those countries, of course, had destroyed themselves in terms of their budget and their ability to maintain their empires. And so we had tons of countries then break off, so much so that after 1945, the number of independent states in the world nearly tripled. And so what happened then? Well, you had a problem of too much unification in a lot of these states. So
by the 70s, you had Biafra, which wanted to break up from Nigeria. And the Nigerian government then didn't want secession. So they maintained a war there. And so had they allowed more decentralization in the wake of the decolonization period, there would have been actually less conflict. There would have been less civil war. There would have been fewer of these conflicts we now see in Africa. That wasn't allowed to happen. But we can point to dozens of situations where there were secession movements and no war broke out. That was just in the most recent 70 or 80 year period. If you look at the chapter I did on a brief history of secession referenda in Europe, we can look at lots of cases. And this is why Mises was so in favor of the idea of just having local plebiscites where a country is allowed to leave and join another country, because that happened in many, many cases throughout the 19th century. This was used to settle border disputes a lot of the time between different European states that existed in the 1800s. And then, of course, used also after World War I to determine which region should be part of which country, because that was decided to be the way that would avoid conflict the most. So again, even before World War II, dozens of cases of countries breaking off, joining other countries, redrawing the borders on a regular basis. So there's really just nothing all that radical about it. It was part and parcel, the outcome of the idea of liberalism, the idea of self-determination, the idea that people should be able to vote on which government they're going to live under. And that just wasn't even controversial in the 1920s when Mises wrote Liberalism and embraced this idea explicitly. But somehow in America, we didn't get the memo.
No, indeed. But the memo has just arrived in the form of your book. Now, that was kind of a ham-handed segue, but I couldn't resist it. I'm looking right at it here. Breaking Away, the Case for Secession, Radical Decentralization, and Smaller Polities by Ryan McMakin. Well, congratulations on it. It's very important. It's interesting, by the way, I remember Don Livingston telling me back in the mid-90s that, now it's probably changed since then, but how many books on secession have been written by philosophers in English? And at that stage, I think partly because of the controversy over Quebec seceding possibly, there was one book, and I forget what the author's name, there was only one. And he took that, he said, the reason for this is that the preconceptions everybody has, whereby central governments are irresistible, indestructible, indivisible, and infallible. And if you accept these Thomas Hobbesian preconceptions, then it becomes metaphysically impossible for you to recognize a legitimate secession, even if one were to occur. So secession is not even, it's not conceivable to you. So because you can't see it, you don't write about it. You know, he says the jackdaw, like many birds, can't see unless it's moving. You know, and so we can't see things because of the preconceptions that we have. And so you don't even have a book on it. You barely have anything. And so it takes the Mises Institute and somebody like you to actually finally write the darn thing.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable. And I suspect, I don't know when Don made that comment, but if you go in and you look at scholarship on secession, very little of it is older than 20 years old.
Right. He said this about 27 years ago.
Yeah. So there was nothing back then. And if you look at the scholarship, mostly done by political scientists and historians, philosophers, boy.
Forget it.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing. They finally are starting over the last 20 years to write about this idea of, I mean, the phrase is used in the scholarship, self-determination. They're resurrecting this idea of, do these local ethnic groups have a right to just break off and redraw the borders and do their own things? And the scholarship is starting to take it very, very seriously. And you're seeing more and more people writing on it. And the idea now, at least among scholars, is that, sure, this is something that has occurred a lot historically. This is a respectable idea. This is something that needs more study. But that other point you make is absolutely right on. What you have are that the people who actually study secession tend to regard it as a somewhat reasonable idea. Now, prudence in many cases may suggest, secession isn't the right idea here and now. This shouldn't occur here, shouldn't occur there. I don't think it's right for my country or whatever. But the idea that it's just crazy talk and unacceptable, that's now in the past tense among people who actually bother to look at the history of secession and to study it. However, among those people who just dismiss it out of hand, they've never read anything on it. They've never read a book. They don't know anything about the history of the idea. They don't know about times that it has occurred peacefully, or the people who have agitated for it, or the theoretical basis behind it, the whole idea of self-determination, its long history as an idea. They don't know anything about that. So try to engage someone who both A, knows a lot about secession and its history, and B, also still opposes the idea as crazy. That's extremely rare, because almost everyone who opposes the idea as crazy has never bothered to actually research the topic. And then once you do start to research it, you find, oh, well, okay, I don't support it in the year 2022 for my local region, but I can see how in many places and times it is the appropriate thing. So we are still overcoming big, big barriers in terms of most of the population just don't ever think about it. And so when you do mention it, it seems completely radical to them, even though it has a long and illustrious history.
Well, I'll just say that when there's a brand new idea that nobody's talked about or considered, but the regime wants it, it gets out there. It's on the Sunday talk shows. It's a talking point in the newspapers and whatever. The idea gets out there. When it's an idea that the regime does not support, everybody knows what to do. Just don't talk about it. There's no roundtable discussions of this on CNN or in the New York Times. If Marjorie Taylor Greene made mention of national divorce, they eviscerated her for this. Nobody is allowed to talk about it, so they just don't. And in fact, somebody just emailed me. We'll wrap up here in a second, but somebody just emailed me to say, you know, you say all the time we're not allowed to talk about secession, but you've written a book on it and you talk about it all the time. Okay, I don't literally mean that if you open your mouth and the word secession comes out, you go to prison. What I mean is there is an unstated set of rules about what it is to be part of the American political conversation and what it is to be somebody who's brought a stink bomb to a party. And that's what talking about secession is, which is why political leaders don't talk about it. The mainstream media doesn't talk about it. Up until recently, even academia didn't talk about it. That's what I'm talking about. Not literally I'm going to prison if I say it, but that there are some ideas that get a big boost and some ideas that get the boot. And that's basically what's been happening. So your book, just by the mere fact of existing, advances the conversation, because it means that the idea has to be reckoned with, even if only to be ridiculed. It has to be entertained and talked about the more we talk about it. So that's why you should go out and get your copy of Breaking Away, which I will link to at tomwoods.com/2223. Ryan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.